Gentlemen, our first case for argument, River East. Mr. Zimmerman, Mr. Lammerman.
Good morning. May it please the court. This is Forrest Lammerman appearing on behalf of the appellants. Also in the courtroom at council table are counsel for the Chapter 11 debtor, Daryl Deasing, and Mike Gossman, and my partner, David Kane. This is a case about whether the debtor and the other plan proponent can use replacement collateral to make a plan of reorganization viable in the context of a single asset real estate case. Replacement collateral is needed in context to allow a real estate project to be used as lien-free collateral to obtain first lien construction financing to develop the project. The project, when developed, will require an additional $40 to $50 million in construction financing to build 150 residential units on the existing structure and to improve the retail and office space on the first two floors of the project. The creditor, the undersecured creditor, is L&V. L&V is a vulture investor. They bought the loan at 40% of its then outstanding balance after...
What?
Pardon me?
The what investor?
A vulture investor.
Oh, forget that.
It's a kind of antiquated term. I don't
Look,
mean that.
It's a perfectly reasonable transaction.
There's I agree with that.
There's nothing wrong with it.
Yes. The purpose of invoking the election was to defeat the plan, not to be paid on account of the election claim. The plan proponents proposed to use Treasury bonds as substitute collateral to allow the project to obtain financing. If the financing is obtained after settling
the original loan was just 3 years, wasn't it?
I believe it was renewed at some point, Your Honor. Yes.
Well, 30 years at a fixed interest rate is not the equivalent of a three-year loan.
That's true, Your Honor, although there's absolutely no reason that loans can't be stretched out over time under the bankruptcy code.
How about inflation? You've got a fixed interest treasury bond. That doesn't cover inflation.
If by inflation you mean that there may be a change in interest rates in a different era, I suppose that's true, but we have to use the interest rates that are in effect now.
No, you don't. No, you're straight. Of course there's going to be a change in interest rates. What do you think these bonds will be worth? Suppose interest rates, you know, the country has severe fiscal problems. Suppose the interest rate doubled to 6%. What would these bonds be worth?
I suppose the interest would, their market value would go down somewhat, just as...
What do you mean somewhat? How much would it go down?
I don't have a table on that.
It would go down 50%. It would have to, right?
It might go down that much, but it might go up, too.
It has to go down 50% if interest rates double, right?
Right now, that...
Look, suppose you have a $100 bond, and the interest rate on it is 6%. It's a new bond. And now you have an old bond for $100 paying 3%. Well, no one is going to buy that old bond, 3% bond, until the price falls to 50, and then it's paying 6%, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
The yield of the bond and the price of the bond are inverse to each other. So you take a person as a three-year mortgage, and you give him the $13 million in bonds, which are likely to be worth much less, or can be worth much less. I mean, you can always hold it to maturity and get your money out. But at the end of the 30 years, inflation may have wiped out the entire value of the bonds.
The creditor who receives the bond, who wants to protect itself against fluctuation in market rates, can sell the right to the proceeds of the bond at any time. There's a market for these things, Your Honor. And the market has changed even during the course of this.
What's the third? Is someone going to spend? How much? These risks are risks that other people are going to perceive as well.
But during the course of even the...
He should sell the bonds for the $13 million and then invest them in something else. Is that the idea?
They could do that if they chose to. They would have that protection if they were worried about fluctuations in interest rates.
But $13 million today is not as valuable as having... As having a lien in this building, right?
No, I don't believe so, Your Honor, because the building requires $40 to $50 million in construction financing for it to go forward. The lien in the bonds is steady, it's predictable, it's the kind of thing that people put into fixed income portfolios.
But LNV obviously much prefers to have the lien on the building rather than the bonds.
I don't believe that to be true, Your Honor. I think that the purpose of making the election under these circumstances is not a purpose of trying to obtain different collateral. The point is to simply defeat the plan. They made the election knowing that the election couldn't be made, they thought.
Why did they want to defeat the plan?
They would prefer to take the property in foreclosure. Pardon me?
Why?
I don't know exactly what their policies are, but they don't desire to be paid under the election claim. What they desire is to be able to foreclose and go forward and not be subject to the constraints of the bankruptcy code.
Because those constraints with the $13 million bonds gives them much less security than their land.
I don't think we know that, Your Honor. It depends upon what happens with interest rates over time. They go up and down. We're a long, prolonged...
...judgment that they don't want to gamble with the $13 million in bonds.
We know they don't want to. But I think under the code...
It gives them better security.
It gives them complete security based upon the provisions of the code. They're entitled to be paid the face amount of their claim under the election claim. The full face amount, but in future payments having a present value equal to the current value of their collateral, and that's what the Treasury bond provides.
But they don't, because they don't protect against inflation risk.
The current interest rates are somewhat lower than they were on 30-year Treasury bonds in the spring. It seems to me that it's a factual question what level of bonds we would need to purchase in order to satisfy the requirements of present value.
But everyone expects, housing prices are enormously depressed, so there's a widespread expectation that housing prices will recover. Bond prices are extraordinarily low because of the international financial crisis. And it's anticipated, or it's certainly a danger, that interest rates will rise, in which event the value of the bonds falls. And then you have meager security. So,
if you're not selling the bond, but you're simply being paid...
Yeah, but you're sitting... You can always hold on to the bonds to maturity, and you'll get your money out, but the money may be worth very little, whereas as the property appreciates in value, the lien will be worth more, and possible to sell it to someone else.
That's true, Your Honor, but when we first proposed the plan in the spring, at that time, interest rates on 30-year treasuries were approximately 4.2%, which is almost a point over prime. Under the Supreme Court's analysis of cram-down interest rates in the Till case of a few years ago, prime plus one in a very secure investment would probably be deemed to be a very reasonable interest rate. We might have to pay a little bit more to get a bond that was issued in the spring as opposed to one that was issued more recently when interest rates for 30-year treasuries have fallen to about 3%, but we might be required to do that.
So far we've been talking about whether the substitute collateral is equivalent for purposes of the sub 3 cram down provision. We haven't really talked about the legal issue about whether that provision operates as sort of an omnibus provision and how it interplays with the 1111 sub B2 election, if at all. As I understand, the argument that's being made by your opponents is that it doesn't apply at all. Perhaps you'd like to address that.
Yes, I would. I think that's mistaken. Without repeating the arguments of statutory interpretation that we put into our briefs, I think the code plainly does not forbid it and seems to anticipate that the cram-down Route 3, which is the indubitable equivalent, can be used to handle an election claim. The legislative history plainly says it, flat out, that if the electing creditor's claim is given the indubitable equivalent, that the court can cram down the plan over the objection.
Is the indubitable equivalent intended for oversecured creditors?
I think it's intended also for undersecured creditors to the extent that they have a lien.
But with undersecured, this is a racket, right? I mean, oversecured. Say to the creditor, you're not entitled to have more security than your loan, so we're going to give you something equivalent to, you know, the complete security on your loan, but not more security. That makes perfectly good sense. But if you're undersecured, like this company, like LNV, then you give them an indubitable equivalent, it's going to be worth less as a practical matter. That's why you're doing it, right? You don't want them to have the lien because you think you can, you can do better if he doesn't have that very secure security.
We can do better only if we obtain construction financing and put in $40 to $50 million in additional financing into the building, and then succeed in the marketplace in selling the resulting product. I think there are many real estate developers and other real estate investors around town and around the country who found out to their chagrin in recent years that the market is extremely volatile.
Sure, you may fall on your face, but meanwhile, LNV has this very inadequate collateral in the form of these bonds.
I think it's more valuable collateral presently. There's been a flight to security and safety in the marketplace. Even during the two debt ceiling crises we had.
The only reason people are buying bonds and the treasury securities and the interest rates are so low is that the rest of the global financial market is in total disarray, so people are desperately looking for safe securities. I mean, it's assumed the United States will not default on its bonds, so that makes them safe. But in a couple of years, when one hopes the financial system recovers, 3% bonds are going to be very undesirable.
If the creditor who receives them under a plan believes that, they should sell their right to the bonds and invest in something else. If they don't believe that, they should hang on to the bonds as a nice hedge against a very sloppy economy.
But look what you're doing. Here's a company has a lien on the bonds. It has a lien on the real estate. And you say to them, look, we want this real estate. We don't want you having a lien here. So we'll give you these bonds. If you don't like the bonds, sell them. Find something better. Well, that seems a little tough on someone who's just an innocent lienor, and you're saying go out and become a bond speculator. Figure out what 3% treasury bonds are really worth, and then sell them for something else, you know, and what do you end up with?
I don't think they would have to be a bond speculator. I think there's a pretty fluid, liquid market for these things, and they can find out very easily what they're worth.
Estimating the risk and the likely future returns of different forms of security, that's not necessarily a simple thing to do. They think they're in the real estate business. You want to put them into the bonds or the real estate financing business. You want to put them into the securities speculation business.
I think we have the right to do that under the code. A replacement lien is allowed. There is no restriction.
The simple rule is suggested by the bankruptcy judge. You elect to, you're the creditor, you elect to keep the lien. You have the lien. They can't substitute against you unless you're oversecured. Because if you're oversecured, you have more protection than you need, and you're interfering with the ability of the reorganization to succeed. But if you're undersecured, why not just, leave you with the security?
Well, if the creditor is undersecured, that's no reason they can't be given replacement collateral, Your Honor. It seems to me that it's precisely in these kinds of situations that in order to be able to reorganize, there needs to be the ability to use the flexible plan routes that the code provides, and one of them...
The creditor, you could, of course, have your $40 million investor or something pay off the lien. But instead, you want to turn the lien into some 30-year process with uncertain consequences, just so you can have a bigger shot at rehabilitating the building. You'll get the profits, and they get less desirable collateral.
Well, they get something that right out of the box is equal to the present value of their collateral.
I don't think so.
They haven't said otherwise.
Well, why do you think they're opposing this?
I think they would prefer to foreclose, that they have probably a portfolio of real estate that they've bought by buying notes.
Why would they prefer to foreclose?
I think they probably are long-term investors who hope that some of these investments will turn out if the market comes back.
What's wrong with that?
I don't think there's anything wrong with it. I don't think the code necessarily honors their intent to be investors in real estate loans only. I think the code allows alternative means of collateral to be used. If the collateral that's given them is, one, equal in value.
The election, in order to elect, they had to give up their chance for a deficiency judgment, right?
That's correct.
So they've already given up part of their claim against the debtor. Now you want to give them up the collateral they want. That's a double blow against them.
I don't think so, Your Honor. In the first place, we gave them an opportunity in the plan that provided for the election treatment. We also gave them an option of consensual treatment that allowed them to keep what we defined as roughly the equivalent of what they would have gotten on their unsecured deficiency claim, because we wanted them to have options. We would have preferred for them not to make the election claim, because the election claim makes financing for the reorganization and development of the project extremely difficult to achieve. We wanted to give them something that would either give them what they the value of their collateral now, plus something on their deficiency claim roughly equal to what other creditors would get on a percentage basis, or give them replacement collateral if they preferred to be paid out over time. Replacement collateral reflects roughly current interest rates, but we think as a matter of law we're allowed to give that kind of collateral so long as the collateral is, one, equally valuable to the collateral that it replaces, and two, is at least as safe. And we believe it's much safer. The marketplace has shown that. And even during the debt ceiling crisis, people fled to bonds, treasury bonds.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Lamerman. Mr. Gilden?
Your Honor, if I may, I'm Robert Rodasiewicz for LNB.
Okay.
Cameron Golden is here on behalf of the United States Trustee's Office. He didn't necessarily want to monopolize any argument time, but is here to answer whatever questions the Court might have. Should the Court have any, we reserve the minute at the end of mine should the Court have some questions. With us at council table are my partners, Mark Burkoff and Nick Miller, along with Mark Schiffman, or David Schiffman from Sidley, and Rob Ackerman. Judge Weedoff had it exactly right. What they proposed to give us is not the indubitable equivalent of our claim, our $38.4 million claim supported by this real estate. The alternative treatment they gave us in our plan, in the plan, was essentially to reverse our 1111B election, saying, well, we don't want to give you your 1111B election. Here's what we're going to consider the value of your collateral, and we're going to pay you what we think you would get for your unsecured claim. Take that as consensual treatment, because we would have to consent. We said no. Then they'll take that same $13.5 million and cash us out of our property that we spent 2 years trying to foreclose on, and give us a lien on stagnant 30-year Treasury bonds at historically low interest rates. They can't do that. That's cashing us out. And the notion that we can hedge our bets in the market by going out and selling these bonds, we don't even own the bonds. We just have a lien in the bonds. So if this debtor were to foreclose, or the debtor wanted to sell the property in 3 years, when it escalated to $40 million so we could get about a $25 million recovery or $15 million recovery, we just have to foreclose on the bonds, get the bonds, put them in our pocket, and wait another 27 years to get paid. That's not the indubitable equivalent of anything. They continually harp in their briefs that the only thing we're entitled to is the interest pay, or is the payment plan provided for under A1. That's true. If you have an A1 plan, Congress was meticulous in saying, okay, if you want to stretch out a debtor, or creditor rather, if you want to maintain the collateral, we're going to show you how to do that in A1. And part of A1 is keep your lien on the property. Congress said that. And indubitable equivalent is something entirely different. This court recognized that in River Road. So if you're going to do something different, try it in a indubitable equivalent. And I agree with you, Judge Posner, that most of the cases discussing a indubitable equivalent are for oversecured creditors, where they, 9 times out of 10, want to carve up the oversecured creditor's collateral, give it some of its collateral, and maintain some in the estate. And courts struggle with that mightily in determining how do we value real estate, which is a very difficult thing to value. And the Wallet Farms decision back from 1985 is a wonderful decision where they talk about the difficulty in valuing collateral and how you never see this issue with fungible commodities pledged as collateral. None of these sections are strict to real estate. They could be used for other assets, but you don't see it with fungible commodity, because why go through the rigmarole of a plan and crushing it down? Just sell some of the commodity, use the money, and pay off the creditor. And that's what happens with fungible commodities. It's only with real estate that you run into this problem. And SLC Investments, the new investor and the new equity owner of this debtor, wants to spend $2 million on the equity, though I have difficulty conceptualizing how the equity in this property is worth $2 million when it's underwater about $25 million. Leave that on the side for a second. They want to spend $2 million on the equity for the opportunity to develop the property. Well, we want to develop the property. That's why we raise our 1111B election. We don't like this plan. We want to go back to foreclosure so we can foreclose on our interest and get the property. And that's what 1111B effectively does, because if we were to get the property, we could then take advantage of the appreciation and value. And everyone who's ever looked at 1111B said it's there for the same thing, to allow an electing creditor to realize appreciation and the value of its collateral. Now, the legislative history of 1111B talks about, or of A3, the indubitable equivalent, talks about a couple of different ways to have a indubitable equivalent. Surrendering the collateral, that's what happened in Sandy Ridge, which is one of the only cases where there was an undersecured creditor, and they gave the creditor all of its collateral back and said, here, whatever your claim is, it's this collateral here, take it all. Or replacement collateral, similar replacement collateral. Clearly, a 30-year stagnant bond at historically low interest rates is not this 245,000-square-foot mixed-use property in the North River District. They're not the same under any conceivable stretch of the imagination. And, Judge Posner, I also think you're right. I think in 5 years, these bonds aren't going to be worth prime, or they're not going to be worth par, because interest rates are going to rise. And so if they rise to 6%, now these bonds are worth $6 million. And we have to, again, hold them for 27 years or 25 years until we can foreclose on them. It's not a confirmable plan. Had they wanted to do an A1 plan, stretch out our payments, pay us the court-determinated value of our collateral in terms of present dollars and the total amount of our claim over time, we could have had that conversation. We could have talked about interest rates. We could have talked about whether 30 years in today's commercial market is ever a reasonable time to stretch out a lender. We could have talked about those things, but we would have kept our lien. And that didn't happen. They want to take AirDime and stand it on its head. Because in AirDime, the FCC was made an 1111B election, and a debtor went out and was going to buy government-backed annuity, government-backed securities, or grade A annuities to provide the income necessary to make the plan payments post-petition so it could avoid an A11 feasibility argument that the debtor post-petition couldn't pay for its own operation to make plan payments. So it went ahead and bought some bonds to remove that. Then the question before the court, after it got done with some gnarly jurisdictional issues, was whether the provisions in the FCC regulations talking about due-on-sale clauses, so if you sold one out of 12 of the licenses, the entire indebtedness would accelerate, was part of the lien that had to be maintained in an A1 analysis for an 1111B electing creditor. And the court said, no, those are payment terms. We can adjust payment terms. But the FCC kept its lien. If any of the licenses were sold, it would get all of the proceeds. And if the proceeds weren't sufficient to pay off the lien, its lien would continue until it's paid. That is when the stretch-out payments come into play. That's when you can use additional collateral in order to provide an income stream to facilitate plan payments. The FCC was given a lien on, or was going to be given a lien on those annuities and those government-backed securities. So if that would have been sufficient, if you could have flipped its lien from the licenses to the liens for the government-backed securities, which are in the same amount, $33 million, you would have never had a conversation about the due-on-sale clause. You would have never had a conversation about, in your decision, about the court, about FCC maintaining its lien on the property, on the licenses, so it could get paid as the licenses were sold. That's how it works. They stand this process on its head. So they have a masquerading A1 plan, trying to get confirmation under A3, and are trying to strip an 1111B electing creditor of its only right as an 1111B electing creditor, which is to realize appreciation in the value of its collateral. That's it. That's what we want to do. They don't want us to. I understand that. They also think it's too expensive to just pay us off with their new lender with SLC Investments, because SLC Investments doesn't want to come up with $38.4 million to pay us off. They only want to give us $12.5 million. Well, too bad. Then you can't confirm a plan. Because we made the election. To remove our lien, we have to be paid in full. And a dubable equivalence really has nothing to do, we don't think, with the value of our collateral. It's our claim. And once a creditor makes an 1111B election, it doesn't get its claim bifurcated under 506, and its claim is its entire claim against the property, which doesn't get removed until it's paid. This is simple. We don't think that there's a question that this plan was confirmable. We think Judge Woodoff was correct when he said the plan didn't have a reasonable possibility of being confirmed within a reasonable time. He also properly exercised his discretion in lifting the stay as opposed to some other relief, which frankly would have just done an end around the 90-day period in 362D3 anyway. They in their briefs, they contest and try to make it as a matter of law decision that Judge Woodoff made to lift the stay entirely. He didn't make it as a matter of law. He said in the transcript we cited to the extent I have discretion, I'm going to exercise it and lift the stay, because that's what 362D3 is all about. This debtor is a poster child for 362D3. We've been in foreclosure. This loan matured 2 years ago. We've been in foreclosure for 2 years. They filed the bankruptcy the day after the foreclosure. They're a poster child. That's what we did is exactly what was supposed to happen under 362D3. Judge Woodoff got it right. And the court should affirm on all respects.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Radicevich. So, Mr. Goulden, do you have anything you'd like to say?
I'm Cameron Goulden on behalf of the United States Trustee. As the court knows and as our briefs indicate, we're not involved in the main legal issue. I just wanted to be here in case the court had any questions regarding dismissal of the Chapter 11 case. If not, I'll rest on our brief.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr.
Thank you, Your Honor.
So, Mr. Lammerman, your time expired, but you can have another minute or so if you'd like.
Thank you, Your Honor. On the issue of whether the indubitable equivalent in the form of replacement collateral can be given to an undersecured creditor, I think that it's simply true on the face of legislative history that that's the case. The undersecured creditor is an election creditor. Only an undersecured creditor can make the election by the terms of Section 1111. So that's the nature of the case. And then the legislative history plainly says that Romanet 3 of the cramdown provisions.
Why would it ever be appropriate to give an undersecured creditor alternative security? Because if the alternative security is really alternative, it'll be as costly to the debtor as the original security, right? What's the gimmick that allows the debtor to give something which really is the equivalent, and it somehow makes the debtor better off?
There are a couple of questions there. I'll do my best. I think the key is that the code provides that the debtor provide replacement collateral that's equal to the present value of the lender's collateral, not equal to what the collateral may have been worth earlier or what the total amount of the claim is. It's collateral that is equal in value to the current value.
That's terrible. No, you can't mean that.
It's what the code says, I believe, Your Honor.
You're giving them collateral that's worth less?
It's worth less than
the indubitable equivalent.
No, it has to be collateral that's worth as much as the lender's collateral is now. It may have been worth more years earlier.
But this is something dealt with at length in the briefs. You can't have a situation where because the value of collateral is temporarily depressed, the debtor can declare bankruptcy and minimize the expense to the debtor by doing so at a time when the collateral is depressed, as housing is and buildings are in the present.
Your Honor,
that's
I think
exactly what that Pine decision permitted and has caused an uproar in congressional legislation. No, you can't just pounce on a creditor when his collateral is depressed and say, all right, your collateral is depressed. Now we're going to give you collateral which will always be depressed. It will have no chance of becoming more valuable.
Your Honor, the 1129A7B says that the plan has to give the electing creditor property of a value as of the effective date of the plan that is not less than the value of such holder's interest in the estate's interest in the property. In other words, the property that has to be given must be equal to the current value.
No, that's wrong.
It's what the code says,
Yeah, but that destroys creditors' rights, right?
It destroys
you wait
creditors'
till there's
rights.
A temporary depression in the value of the collateral, and you take the collateral away and replace it with something which will never grow, even though the original collateral, the real estate, well, that's quite likely to rise in the future, but the bonds aren't going to rise in the future.
I don't think that real estate is always quite likely to rise in the future. Bonds do have a steady stream.
That's the form of collateral that this lender negotiated for when he made the loan. He didn't want bonds. He's not in the bonds business. He wants the real estate.
No, I understand that they want something else. I think the appropriate analogy here is with the mortgage defeasance business. Back in the late 80s and early 90s, mortgage defeasances were worked out using substitute collateral that consisted primarily of commercial real estate. And then there was a big fall in the commercial real estate market, and the dependability of that form of substitute collateral was called seriously into question. As a result, the current wave of defeasance vehicles gives buckets of treasury bonds as a substitute collateral that will step in if the underlying primary collateral fails in some way. And there's a reason for that, and that is the reliability and predictability of treasury bonds to make sure that an obligation is paid out over time. If the lender thinks otherwise, and these are highly sophisticated people, they're able to figure out how they want to invest. If the lender thinks otherwise and they get the treasury bonds and they believe that the market will change, they're perfectly free to cash that in and do something else. The purpose of the appreciation issue in connection with the election was not to allow the lender to obtain the full value of the collateral if the real estate sprang back magically in value and went beyond the amount of the current debt, $38 million, up to $100 million in value. There's a formula for payment, and the formula for payment is simply that the creditor is entitled to the face amount of the debt and paid in deferred payments over time that are equal to the present value of the collateral. That's the root.
Well, the equal is the question.
Yeah.
And if you pick a time when the collateral is depressed, probably temporarily, and you replace it with collateral which doesn't have the same profile, the same growth potential, then of course you're screwing the creditor. That's the whole purpose.
No, the idea is to survive and go on with an investment, not to screw the creditor. The creditor is assured of getting paid, and if they don't like the form of the collateral, they can take that money.
That business of having them go into the bond market is ridiculous. They don't want to be in the bond market.
Well, I don't know whether they want to be in the bond market or not,
but
if they don't want to, they've got something that's liquid. They can take that and invest in another real estate investment.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Nisbet and Mr. Lammerman, and take the case under advisement.